The next matter on this morning's calendar is the case of State of Minnesota versus Ronald James Leip. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. Please feel free to adjust the podium to your desired height. And please identify yourself for us.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Christina Zahar, and I, along with Marsh Hallberg, represent the appellant Ronald Leip. A prosecutor may not seek conviction at any price. In the prosecution of Mr. Leip, the state obtained a conviction of second-degree criminal sexual conduct as a result of the district court's erroneous decision to not allow discovery of a subsequent touching incident involving the child complainant, pervasive prosecutorial misconduct during closing arguments, as well as other cumulative issues.
Which do you think is the greatest error?
The greatest error in this case, Your Honor, is the district court's decision to deny our motion for a continuance just on the day before trial, or in the alternative, grant our request for an in-camera review of the evidence that we were seeking. That was a very damaging error in this case. And the biggest problem with that error that the court made is that the court did an admissibility analysis rather than a discoverability analysis. The facts here, on two business days prior to trial, we received a one-sentence email from the state that the child complainant was involved in touching with the same-aged child. We do not have any further details about what that means, who was touching who, when this occurred, where it occurred, and for that reason requested a continuance so we could look a little further into that issue as it potentially and seemingly was very similar to the defendant's version of what happened in this case. In the alternative,
it could be similar given the age difference.
Well,
you have a similar age child and you have a very young child. It seems kind of bizarre to say that that's similar that way.
It potentially was very similar. What the defendant was saying in this case and what he testified to is that the child would grab his hand and bring it to her genital areas almost like it was itching or not realizing that was an inappropriate thing to do. There was also testimony by her mother and the social worker that at the time of the alleged incident, she wasn't aware that that was inappropriate to do. So she had not had those conversations or that education yet about good touch and bad touch and appropriate sexual boundaries. So if this incident with another child involved her grabbing another child's hand and touching to her genital areas, that would be extremely similar conduct to what the defendant alleged happened here in this case. And that was the reason we wanted to discover more evidence about what happened here. We have no information whatsoever other than that one-sentence email.
In the state's brief, it seems like there was a little bit of additional information about touching each other's genitals as opposed to a touching incident or whatever the language was.
And we never received any additional information other than the one-sentence email that is cited in our brief. I do not believe the state would have any additional information, but that would be for them to argue. We received a single sentence email and at no point received any further information about what was happening.
Do you know why this was assigned to a different judge than the trial judge? That is the motion to either exclude or have a parity examination?
That's correct. So that issue was determined by not the trial judge. That was the Honorable Judge Idy that made that decision. I believe it was just a scheduling issue.
Just couldn't get in to see the other judge.
Yep, Judge Idy heard that issue, and then Judge Wenzel heard the remainder of the trial and the remaining issues, which is an important fact, as Judge Idy also did not have the same type of background information on the case, even though we did present at that motion hearing preemptively disclosed to the state in open court what the defense was going to be for the sake of arguing this motion for the court and to provide them with some background information about how significant this incident with the child complainant really could have been for the defense. if the court had felt that it was a sensitive issue, especially because another child was involved in the case, in the alternative, we were requesting an in-camera review. The court also opted not to do that and instead jumped straight to an admissibility argument about whether the rape shield statutes, so that's Minnesota Statute 609.347 and Rule of Evidence 412, would prevent this evidence from coming in at trial. Our position was that we did not have enough information to even argue that point, whether it be admissible or not. We simply wanted to discover it, or in the alternative, have the court do an in-camera review to determine if there was any relevant evidence to be disclosed to the defense, which at that point would put both parties in a position to appropriately argue whether that evidence would be admissible under the rape shield statutes or not. Even if the court was correct in doing a rape shield analysis, the analysis was incorrect that the court did, and there's two reasons for that. By the unambiguous language of the rape shield statute, only previous conduct is prohibited, as well as sexual incidents. This, by the language of the email that we have, we do not believe that act to have been previous to the alleged incident, nor do we have enough information to determine if it was even sexual in nature, both due to the lack of information as well as the child's very young age. She was 7 years old, 8 by the time of trial, 7 at the time of the alleged incident. Perhaps even more importantly, the court failed to consider defendants' constitutional rights, which is a requirement when looking at evidence that either should or should not come in pursuant to the rape shield statutes. In addition to looking at the language of the statute itself, we know from the Crims case, we know from Friend, we know from Carroll, that a court must look at a defendant's constitutional rights to a fair trial, to a meaningful opportunity to present a complete defense, to offer evidence, and develop the defendant's version of events, which, again, this incident may well have been very similar to what the defendant was alleging. As no additional witnesses testified at trial who may have been present during these incidents, notably the child's brother, A.B., he was 2 years older than her, and E.J.B., the child, stated that he was with and within 2 feet every single time this allegedly occurred. And the child also told law enforcement that her grandma, the wife of the defendant, was present on at least one occasion as well. And as the jury did not hear testimony from either of those two potential eyewitnesses, the credibility of the defendant, Mr. Leip, was extremely critical in this case. And it was very important then for us to be able to bolster and develop his version of the facts of the case. We know from the Crims case that if there is a conflict between the defendant's constitutional rights to a fair trial and to a complete defense and the rape shield statute, that the evidence must be allowed, that it must be admitted. And the court in this case did not consider whatsoever the defendant's constitutional rights, either on the record or in his written order.
Let me ask you this. Let's assume for purposes of the next question that the district court was wrong in its analysis and that it should have either allowed discovery or reviewed the state's information in chambers to determine, you know, whether there should be some further discovery or whether it could possibly lead to relevant evidence. Let's assume that was all wrong. Wouldn't we first have to determine, in order to reverse and remand for a new trial, that the result would have been different?
That's correct, Your Honor. So we must show that there was prejudice as a result of this, of the judge's decision
right,
in this case.
Right, which brings me to my next question, and that is, it seems like this might be better suited to a petition for post-conviction relief so that you could have at it to determine what really was there.
Your Honor, that may be the case. This is also the appropriate forum for this issue. Due to the way the district court handled this analysis that it conducted, it did not, it did abuse its discretion in making a decision to not do a discoverability analysis.
That was part of my assumption, though. Assume that the district court was, that we agree with you, the district court was wrong and it did the wrong analysis. Don't we have to know something more than is in this record in order to reverse and remand?
I don't think this court needs to know something more. The error here in this case does implicate a constitutional right of the defendants, and the state would then need to show, beyond a reasonable doubt, that the court's error was harmless.
Okay.
Thank you. If the court does not have any additional questions on that issue, I will move on to the second issue.
Let me ask you this question. There seems to be an argument being made by the state that the rape shield law does apply to post-charging conduct. And the state seems to, well, strongly indicates that this touching with the similar age child was post-charging. That's how it's referred to by the state. So the state apparently knows more than you do about it. What's your response to this argument that the language in the statute isn't defined about previous sexual conduct, and that basically, I guess the state's position is that the Rape Shield Act applies to anything that happens before the jury is being picked, or maybe before the verdict comes in?
Our response is that the language in the Rape Shield statute is unambiguous. It specifically applies to previous conduct.
Previous to what?
Previous to the alleged incident. And in our brief, we discuss how it does not use the word prior, which is used in another place in the statute to refer to pre-conviction evidence. That would be anything before a conviction and before the incident. The Rape Shield statute uses the word previous. It certainly doesn't use the word subsequent, which it also does in other places of the statute as well. So this language is unambiguous. There is no case, either by the Court of Appeals or the Minnesota Supreme Court, that has looked into this specific issue of what previous means in the Rape Shield statute. We could not find a case where that was argued or where the upper courts have defined those terms. So that is a new issue before this court.
Thank you.
Thank you. The second largest issue in this case has to do with the prosecutorial misconduct during the state's closing arguments in this matter. We know that we must examine arguments as a whole, and throughout the closing arguments in this case, the prosecutor repeatedly violated case law, rules, or other standards in various contradictory ways, repeatedly and significantly throughout the course of the closing arguments. Perhaps most importantly, and related to the issue we were just discussing, is that she directly referenced that the child complainant is not acting this way towards anyone else. She said she is not acting like this towards anyone else. She's not grabbing other people's hands and making them touch her vagina. So why would she be doing this with the defendant and no one else? And that is just one of the items where the district court, in fact, found prosecutorial misconduct. That was just one statement where he made that finding. The district court said it best, that she cannot use the exclusion of evidence, that touching incident was specifically excluded, to then argue the absence of evidence thereof in closing arguments, especially when this is a case that came down almost completely to a credibility decision between the defendant and the child complainant, with no other eyewitnesses testifying, with no other medical evidence or direct evidence of any kind.
Even having said that, that is that the state may not use the exclusion of the evidence to argue about the absence. The district court went on to say that the prosecutor's argument did not misstate the evidence and did not constitute error.
And I would disagree with that. The evaluation of the district court on that point.
It says that.
I agree he says that, but I disagree with that portion of his analysis because we don't know what happened with this child and whether that would be a misstatement of the evidence. We, again, have a single-sentence email. We don't know whether she was grabbing a child's hand or doing anything else. So that is a misstatement of the evidence here. And she was using the absence of that sort of evidence to prejudice the defendant in her closing argument.
As to the timing, it does look like on page 4 of the transcript that Mr. Hallberg indicated to the district court that this other occasion with the other child was, and I'm quoting, subsequent to the alleged incident in this case. So the timing seems to have been known to the defense.
Your Honor, I believe we were saying that in response to conversations that were being had on the record about the matter. We have no hard information other than that email. So no, we.
Mr. Hallberg seems to have. He did say that it happened on another occasion subsequent to the alleged incident.
I think that is an assumption that was made based on the language of that email. Although the email doesn't clearly state when it happened. Due to the timing of when the email was received by the state, I think that was an assumption that both parties were making, that it likely was more recent in time due to the mother just then disclosing the incident. Thank you. To the court, we are asking that you reverse Mr. Leip's conviction and remand this case for a new trial. Thank you very much.
Respondent.
May it please the court. My name is Chris Filipski. I represent the respondent, the state of Minnesota, in this case. As a preliminary statement, I'd like to apologize to the court for the confusion that I may have caused in my brief, where I referred to this conduct as being, I referred to it as post-charge, and if the court reviews the transcript, that the state refers to as transcript one, that is the discussions with Judge Idy about this, there is conversation that this is subsequent to the corner house interview, subsequent to the charge, and as Ms. Zahar indicated, there is the assumption from the state that it was, and from the defense, that this was subsequent to the charge, thus why the state characterized it as post-charge.
So you're just assuming as well?
That's correct, Your Honor. That's correct. I would also point out that in my brief, I mentioned an email that led to the responsive memoranda or brief from the appellant about the state not disclosing any information. That was a mischaracterization on my part. The communication was the phone call from JB to our office that was then provided in email format. So that was a confusion. I apologize for that. That was my fault. In responding...
How is it consistent with fairness and the defendant's constitutional rights to not allow a continuance to explore evidence like this?
Your Honor, it was fair in the sense that...
Well, yes, how was it fair? Why is it fair?
Even for there to be discovery, as Ms. Zahar noted and the appellant argues, they were asking for an in-camera review of this information. And if you look at the in-camera review standard, whether it's parity, that the information that the appellant must make a plausible showing that information was both material and favorable to the defense, and that this wasn't a fishing expedition. And as appellant mentioned and argued today, that it is potentially admissible, that there's potential evidence there.
Well, that's what discovery's about.
That's what plausible means.
It's plausible, but then again, there has to be a plausible showing that it's material and favorable. And the judge's position, if you look at the transcript, was that this evidence was not relevant, so under 401, and that even if it...
Relevant in an admissibility sense.
Correct.
Right.
And the point would be that from a discoverability standard is, I don't know what mechanism the court could have used at that point in time, other than just to allow the defense to conduct its own investigation. Under parity is to allow information that is held under either by a government agency and is protected by data practices, or a privileged situation.
Well, what's wrong with additional investigation?
There's nothing wrong with additional investigation, but I don't know where that investigation would have come from.
I don't either. I mean, I don't know. I don't know what the investigation would have been or where it would have led. But isn't that a problem for all of us here that we don't know?
No, Your Honor, because in the end, I think this information is so irrelevant under 401 and that it would, again, be inadmissible under, even if you did a 403 analysis, if this court were to say this isn't sexual conduct that's precluded or that would be inadmissible under Rape Shield. So even if this court did a straight 401, 403 analysis, you still would have to look to see whether this evidence makes any fact more or less probable.
Well, wasn't though, but the defendant argued in the case that it was his granddaughter who twice had grabbed his hand. So, you know, he obviously didn't assume at the time, if we assume his version is correct, that she was doing that in a sexual nature. But if that's his argument, why is it irrelevant what actually happened in the touching with the child who's a similar age?
The relevance and the irrelevance in this case would come down to the difference, the lack of similarity between this. Now, obviously, we
don't know, though, if it's similar or not similar. We know the ages are different, but we don't know if the conduct is different.
We don't know truly what happened there, other than the message from JB was that EJB and another child engaged in touching.
Well, did the state investigate? Why only a one-liner?
The state didn't investigate because the state did not believe it was relevant information. In addition, there's no duty for the state to investigate unless this were to come in a child protection matter, and then child protection might investigate, or law enforcement would investigate if there was a crime. But a 7 or 8-year-old engaging in potentially childhood conduct is not a matter that would rise to the level of having law enforcement or social services come in and conduct an investigation of that.
What if the conduct happened while they were sitting on a couch watching TV, the very program that was, I don't know what Just in Time is, but that program, what if the circumstances of the touching were substantially identical after discovery to the circumstances of this charged offense?
Then certainly the district court would have to do the analysis. Again, that comes back to the question of...
We know on this record that that's not true.
We don't know. Everything at this point in time about what actually happened there is hypothetical. We don't truly know what happened with EJB and this other minor child. But that notwithstanding, the district court, even if there was discovery, and the discovery comes, and they find out that this was two children engaged in touching, or that she did touch the other child, whatever it may be.
Well, what if you found out that she did virtually the same thing?
Even if that is the case, the district court would still have to go through the analysis for admissibility, and the analysis would be whether this sexual conduct is inadmissible under Minnesota's rape shield law and Rule 412, or whether if the court were to say this isn't sexual conduct, this is some other type of conduct, the court would again still have to apply a 401 and 403 analysis. So even if this does go back and is remanded for further discovery, an admissibility review has to take place by the district court. And it's going to be the state's position at that point in time that, again, we have to review Minnesota's rape shield law to see whether it's admissible, or we have to see whether it applies under 401 or 403.
That gets back to my question that I asked counsel for appellant, and I think I agree with that. I think we might need to know more than we know on this record, but I don't know that we know, as we sit here now, that there's no possible way that the evidence could have resulted in discoverable and maybe even ultimately admissible evidence.
Your Honor, and that's true. And in this case, if the court were to say this was a harmless error, or that this error was harmless, and that it should be, the court has to look to see whether the verdict had this evidence and this damaging, potentially damaging evidence been offered at trial by appellant.
Not this evidence.
No.
The evidence that would have been discovered.
Correct.
But we have no idea what it is because discovery wasn't allowed.
So even, and then in this situation, you have to look to say if whether this evidence that we currently know that there was touching was offered into evidence is going to lead to a different verdict.
Well,
and the state's position is that it's not going to lead to a different verdict. We're going to get in essentially then.
No, it's not going to lead to a different verdict when you don't know what the evidence is. How do you know that?
But no, the problem is nobody knows what the evidence is.
Well, the state knew something when it sent a one-line email.
And that was the same.
You said the state had no reason to investigate.
Because this is not a matter that would have triggered a criminal investigation for law enforcement, and it was not a matter that would have triggered a Health and Human Services investigation for neglect or something like that. So from the state's position, the county attorney's office would have been the ones in charge of doing an investigation into evidence that the county attorney's office did not believe was relevant to the to our case.
Okay, so the state had no duty to investigate, and the state objected to a continuance so that the defense could investigate.
The state's basis for the objection was not to allow for the defense to investigate. The state's basis for the investigation, and this is clear from the record, is that this evidence would have been inadmissible under Minnesota's rape shield law.
Even though you don't know exactly what the evidence was?
Even though we don't know exactly what was said, based on the record that we...
Done. What was done?
Oh, sorry. Apologies. What was done? We don't know truly what was done, but based on what was presented to the state from JB that was provided to the defense, the argument was that even if this comes out and is some horrible act committed by EJB, the court still has to determine at that point whether admissibility occurs or not.
You will argue, should there be another trial, that it's not admissible, whatever it is, and I understand that, but you don't know how that ruling will come out.
Again, we're also talking about the hypothetical of what the conduct is.
We are.
And that's the problem here, is that we can't reverse the clock. We can't go back in time to know truly what happened. And this could have been completely innocent childhood behavior by EJB. We're assuming that these hypotheticals.
The argument is that the child's behavior could have been innocent with respect to her grandfather and vice versa.
And I think the important point to that would be that the jury heard the testimony from the appellant and heard the testimony from EJB. And the jury weighed the credibility of those two arguments. And based on the verdict that the jury reached, they clearly found appellant's argument and testimony to not be credible. The fact that a 58-year-old man was physically overpowered by a 7-year-old and the 7-year-old forced her hand down a 58-year-old or forced a 58-year-old man's hand down her pants, that wasn't credible to the jury. The fact that she somehow did it on accident and that it was innocent, that wasn't credible to the jury. The jury had the opportunity to hear the evidence at trial, which was that EJB grabbed the grandpa appellant's hand and forced it down her pants. They also heard EJB's testimony, which was that he unbuttoned her pants, that he put his hand underneath her underwear, and he touched the bare vagina on several occasions, which he admitted to. So, again, this will come down to, and really what the gist of the sufficiency of the evidence argument was, too, is whether there was a sexual intent. And based on the totality of the evidence, which is that appellant never told anybody about this conduct that occurred, that appellant did this on several occasions, that it was hidden by a blanket, that testimony was sufficient to find that there was sexual intent. Whether or not EJB's incident, this post-incident occurred, isn't going to change, I don't believe, that analysis. They're still, I believe, going to find that it was sufficient and that there was sexual intent because they have to weigh the credibility of the parties. And the jury clearly found EJB's testimony to be far more credible. In regards to appellant's argument that this court has not applied rape shield to subsequent conduct, that is not true. If the court looks at its case law, there are several cases where this court has reviewed district court findings that subsequent conduct was inadmissible under Minnesota's rape shield law. There's the Crims case, which dealt with 4 prior acts. There's the Olson case, which dealt with a delayed report by the victim that the district court ruled was inadmissible under Minnesota's rape shield law. And then most recently, there was an unpublished opinion from March 2018, authored by Judge Rodenberg, where he specifically stated that previous sexual conduct for the purposes of Minnesota's rape shield law includes conduct that was subsequent to the incident. So this court has considered that issue and has applied rape shield to subsequent conduct, meaning that previous for the sense of rape shield and previous for the sense of Rule 412 means previous to the trial. That subsequent includes conduct that occurred after the alleged incident, which we believe is what occurred here. And again, the defense argues that they would have a constitutional right to get this in. If the court looks, Krim said that if this evidence should come in under a constitutional right, then there must be special circumstances. The special circumstances include explaining a fact that issue, explain or if there was bias or ulterior motive, or if there was a pattern of similar behavior. And based on this, there was no fact at issue such as semen, pregnancy, or disease. There was no evidence of motive or bias on the behalf of EJB. And the respondent's argument is that this was not similar conduct because it is so distinct from what was reported, which is EJB grabbing the hand of an adult and putting it down her pants.
You're talking about distinct from the incident with the similar age child.
Correct. Based on what we know.
Which is virtually nothing.
Is that EJB and another child engaged in touching. That they would not even meet that standard for a special circumstance for it to be offered under CRIMS and 403. Your Honor, in regards to the prosecutorial error that occurred in the closing arguments, the district court found two separate incidents of possible error. And if the court reviews that, the court would see that the evidence against the defendant was strong, that any possible error was minimal, and that that the defendant had an opportunity in their own closing argument to address that. Given the time, Your Honor, the respondent would ask that the district court affirm in all respects. Thank you.
Rebuttal.
Thank you. I'd like to begin by addressing whether this court and the Minnesota Supreme Court has applied versus heard the issue of subsequent or previous or prior sexual conduct for the purposes of the rape shield. And although it's true that the Crims case did involve conduct that occurred after the allegation but before the trial, that was not the issue before the court. Both parties had seemingly agreed or chose not to litigate that issue. That was not the issue before the court. So at best, that is dicta from the Crims case, any application of the rape shield to conduct that occurred after an allegation but before a trial. That was not an issue being litigated in Crims or any of those other cases. The state spoke a lot about the credibility of the defendant and the jury's determination of his credibility, and that is exactly why this discovery issue was so important in this case, because this was a trial about credibility, especially on the element of sexual intent. The entire trial, as well as the closing arguments, focused almost primarily on the issue of sexual intent. There was not dispute that the contact occurred. There was not dispute, of course, you know, of the age differences or the relationship of the parties, anything like that. It was all about whether there was sexual intent, which was a necessary element of second-degree criminal sexual conduct. And the state cannot say that the court's error to not allow this discovery was harmless, especially when we're talking about a trial that focused almost entirely on the credibility of the defendant when discussing whether there was sexual intent. The Austin case tells us that there must be evidence of sexual intent to avoid criminalizing either accidental or non-sexual contact that occurs between individuals, in this case, between a grandfather and his grandchild. The purpose of the rape shield statute is to emphasize the general irrelevance of a victim's sexual history, but it is not to remove relevant evidence from the jury's consideration. And that comes from, again, the Crims case. In this case, we had evidence that very well could have been extremely relevant to the credibility of the defendant and the defense in this case that we were not allowed to have access to just 2 days before trial was to begin. The respondent was discussing what the state did or didn't do in response to receiving that information. And on the defense, that is not something we can control. But we could have done our own investigation if we had been allowed additional information about the touching incident between the child and the other child. We would have had the opportunity to have investigators of our own conduct our own interviews to gather additional information to help us determine whether this is something that was admissible or not. Again, it was much too premature for this court to be deciding whether that evidence was admissible or not, and that is the evidence that we were trying to seek. If the court has no further questions for me, I thank you for your time and request that you reverse and remand Mr. Leip's conviction. Thank you.
The matter has been well argued and it is taken under advisement. That concludes our oral calendar for today. We will recess to deliberate.